Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is not working in American public education, and why have well-intentioned efforts to make schools more accountable for student achievement yielded little measurable gain? My guest today spent years as a champion of No Child Left Behind, school choice, and charter schools, believing these solutions might hold special promise for at-risk and special education students. But after observing reform efforts for the past couple of decades, Diane Ravitch has made an about-face, urging political and business leaders who really care about education to get out of the way of the professionals doing the work, and warning that a curriculum that focuses on math and reading to the detriment of science, history, and foreign language will still produce students unprepared to succeed. Diane Ravitch is research professor of education at New York University and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Her new book is called The Death and Life of the Great American School System. She's in town to speak tonight to the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture. Diane, welcome to Think.
Well, it's great to be with you, and I'm happy to be home in Texas.
Yeah, you grew up in Houston.
I did, indeed.
Mm-hmm. Tell me, first of all, you were a supporter of reform efforts that centered around achievement testing and around the sort of business-inspired models. Initially, what made you think these might work?
Well, my fundamental interest has always been in hoping that all kids could get a great education. By great education, I'm talking about one that includes history and literature and geography and civics and foreign languages, sciences, the arts. And so I was very frustrated with what seemed to be in many places just a kind of mediocrity. And so I thought, well, you know, maybe if we turn to testing, this might provide the information we need about where kids stand, and teachers can then look at that information, do a better job. With choice, I thought, well, maybe with choice and with charter schools, there might be schools that would provide good examples that public schools would learn from. And the original vision of choice also was that it would focus on the kids who were hardest to educate and then would become collaborators with the public school system, thus making public schools stronger and better. They would share whatever they learned. Over time, however, as I watched the what No Child Left Behind was doing to the schools, how this testing culture had grown up that became an end in itself, I realized the things that I wanted in education were never going to come from No Child Left Behind. And the choice movement is just, at this point, focused on the same high test scores on these pretty lousy standardized tests that No Child Left Behind is focused on. And in many cities, I don't know about Dallas, but in many cities, it's skimming kids so that the public schools end up worse off.
Because the charter schools attract the best and brightest.
Because they attract the most motivated kids, and also they are taking... And I don't want to generalize because there are some that are exceptions to this, but in general, the charter schools are not taking a fair share of kids with disabilities nor a fair share of kids with limited English proficiency. And so the regular public schools then get a disproportionate number of the kids who are most challenging to educate, making the comparisons between them unfair.
Now, you haven't said we shouldn't have standardized testing in order to evaluate performance, but what are the appropriate ways to actually use those metrics?
Well, we should have testing, and I served 7 years. First of all, I was in the first Bush administration as Assistant Secretary for Research, so I always looked at testing data. And then during the Clinton administration, President Clinton appointed me to the National Testing Board. I spent 7 years on the National Testing Board, and I think the national tests right now are the only tests that I trust because there are no stakes attached and there are no penalties. And so you get an accurate measure of what performance really looks like when there are no stakes attached. What concerns me about the present regime that No Child Left Behind has introduced is the punishments that are attached to testing. And I think that if we could use the test scores for diagnostic purposes and for informational purposes, we would find out where we are, and then we would be able to do something about it. But we have to get rid of this whole regime of punishment because it's the punitive. Now that we've had 8 years of No Child Left Behind, we're seeing schools closed. We're seeing neighborhoods destabilized. We're seeing teachers' whole staffs fired. And with President Obama and Secretary Duncan saying, isn't it wonderful that they fired the whole staff? I think this is a terrible thing. It's like a blight on American education that all these consequences and punishments are now kicking in. This is not improving education. It's just destabilizing it.
So why not close down or sort of clean out schools where most of the students seem to be failing to meet standards?
Well, I think what we need is I would love to see, if I had a few minutes with President Obama, I would say your approach is wrong. No school is going to get better as a result of being closed, because there are many examples now of brand new schools that are also failing schools. And what the when you bring the charter sector in and they're run by entrepreneurs, whether they're for-profit entrepreneurs or nonprofit entrepreneurs, they're both kinds, what they'll do is exclude the low-performing kids, or if they have too many low-performing kids, they'll kick them out. And so they get bounced back to the regular public school system. But if you have a school that's called a failing school, it's usually a school that is serving very low-performing kids. And just closing the school doesn't change the conditions of learning. You really do have to look at what are the specific problems there? Is it that there are many, many children who don't read or speak English? Is it that there is extreme poverty? Is it that there's a transient immigrant population where the children are migrant laborers? I mean, there are all kinds of different reasons. And so what I would say to the president is, why don't you encourage the states to create inspection teams for every single low-performing school in your state? Go into the school, do a diagnostic, find out what the problems are, make specific recommendations about how they can improve the school, and then make sure that they have the technical resources, the teacher training, the professional development, whatever they need to improve that school. And you cannot, until you have exhausted every possibility, say that the school itself is a failing school. It may be just a school serving lots of low-performing kids.
You know, Diane, it strikes me that the three things you just identified as chronic problems in low-performing schools, poverty and a transient population and a low English proficiency population, mm-hmm. are three things that no school can really affect. We can't change what the home situation is. We can't change how often students move. Is it really possible to level the playing field so that a student from a really disadvantaged background has the same shot at opportunity as a middle-class kid with, you know, parents who at least have a full high school education?
Well, the schools alone can't do it. I think this is one of the great myths of our day. And you'll often hear people like, whether it's the Michelle Rhee in Washington, D.C., or Joel Klein in New York City, or Secretary Arne Duncan will say, poverty is just an excuse. Well, that's silly. I mean, anybody who's spent any time reading social science literature knows that you can look at any test that's administered, and the single most reliable predictor of performance is affluence and poverty. Kids from affluent homes have the advantage of being surrounded with books and vocabulary and knowledge, college-educated parents frequently. Kids in poverty, frequently their parents don't speak English. They have no books in the home. The parents, if they have parents, are out looking for a job, and the kids will frequently miss school because they're babysitting while their parents are not home and someone has to take care of the baby sister or baby brother. So you can't say that the school alone is going to level the playing field. You will always find poor kids who can do incredibly well no matter how bad their circumstances. And you'll always find rich kids who are dummies and who are you know, just mess-ups, and they are going to fail, or they make themselves fail for whatever reason. But these kids at the extremes are defying the odds. Mm-hmm. The odds are created by affluence and poverty. And I think we have to, you know, we have to look at kids' health. We have to look at the well-being of their families and their communities. And as long as we have vast income inequality, it's the school alone is not going to be able to overcome that gap.
Is it the responsibility of schools, or does it need to become the responsibility of schools to make sure that students are physically fit?
I think it's part of the responsibility. That's why schools have physical education. And if a teacher sees that a child is coming to school covered with bruises, well, yeah, she's got to report this to whoever the appropriate officials are, that the child may be subject to being beaten at home. That's certainly going to get in the way of his being ready to take a math or reading test. Similarly, I think that we have health classes so that children learn in school how to take better care of themselves. They learn what good nutrition is. They understand something about the way their bodies function. So that's, for about 100 years, been part of the function of American public schools.
Let's talk about the things that get left behind, and pardon me for using that expression, when we focus almost exclusively on math and reading scores.
Yeah, well, this is really important, and it's one of the themes in my book that what we're leaving out by focusing on not just reading and math, but also taking a kind of an approach to pedagogy that says what you really need to learn is strategies, how to learn math, how to learn reading, how to look at yourself as a learner. And then you learn all these catchphrases. I'm a reflective practitioner. I'm a reflective learner. I'm doing a text-to-text connection. I mean, all this sounds like mumbo-jumbo, but that's what a lot of schools are doing today. By having this exclusive focus on basic skills, we are expanding the amount of time, because basic skills count. We test them. The test scores matter. Your school will be closed if you don't get the right scores. Your staff may be fired if you don't get the right scores. You may get a bonus or merit pay if you get higher scores, but only on reading and math. So when you incentivize only basic skills, there really is no incentive then for teaching history or civics or literature or geography or foreign languages or science. And we live in an age when we have to worry about what kind of citizens we're producing. We have to worry about these young people in school today are going to be voting in a few years. They're going to decide who our leaders are. If they don't know anything about our country or about the rest of the world, our whole country's in trouble. If they don't know anything about science because they didn't have time for that, that's terrible. I know business leaders talk a lot about how we're doing globally and our international competitiveness. The last international test that was given was a test of math and science. And American eighth graders actually, this was 2007, our scores went down in science. They were a little bit higher in math, but not very much. They went down in science. And this is terrible. They're not going down in the countries that we consider ourselves competitors with.
Diane Ravitch is my guest. She's research professor of education at New York University and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Her new book is called The Death and Life of the Great American School System. She's in town to speak tonight to the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us now at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. I'm joined now by Jeff Whittington. And Jeff, I presume that we have copies of Dr. Ravitch's book available at the $120 contribution level. All you have to do is make a contribution to KERA of $120. And if you choose, you can receive this as your thank you gift. Of course, we have to say this every day at this hour.
Sure.
You can buy the book for $26.95, be a great investment, and then just give $90 to KERA.
Well, we don't have to say it.
But we choose to say it because full disclosure.
Yeah,
all about
absolutely.
That.
We're not selling a copy of this book to you for $120. Of course, you've already purchased the product that we're selling. That's the programming you hear on KERA, your public radio station for North Texas. We're just trying to incentivize your participation in the station with a copy of the book when you join at the $120 level, with a Think mug when you join at the $60 membership level. There are a wide variety of ways that we can say thank you. And we try to do it every single day when we do the show. We bring you discussions that enable you to talk to people like Dr. Diane Ravitch, who is here today in North Texas. So, you know, this is your opportunity every day to get involved with a conversation that is that's just, you know, something you're not going to find anywhere else.
1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number. You can also go online to kera.org and make a contribution there. One great joy in doing this show, and Jeff and I have talked about this a lot, is the ability to speak to someone of the caliber of Diane Ravitch for an hour. We don't have to speak to her for an hour and then make it down into, you know, 2 minutes worth of sound bites in a package. We don't have to speak to her for 2 minutes and try to make sense of something as complex as public education. Truthfully, we could go on for 6 hours and just barely scratch the surface, but it's a luxury in broadcasting today to have this kind of time. You make it possible. Your dollars make it possible. We try to do things as inexpensively as possible here, but we do have some fixed costs that can't be changed if we don't want to sacrifice the quality of the programming.
And we know that a topic like today's topic is something that really appeals to you. As I'm sitting here, Chris, watching the phone board fill up
with calls.
With calls right now to talk on the show, to make a comment, to ask a question. We cover this particular issue several times a year, actually at least once every 2 months, if not once a month, in some facet with some different perspective. And we always hear from you that this is, our country's education and the education system is such an important topic as we move forward as a member of this community of nations. We address it right here locally, regularly on the show, and we're asking you to say thanks for that by calling and making a financial contribution at 888-694-6931 or online at kera.org. You know, public radio is sort of the continuing education for everyone, so please help keep it strong in North Texas.
1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number. You can also make a contribution online at kera.org with a credit or a debit card. You can set up a sustaining membership, which is sort of a monthly draw from your checking account. And if you want to make a $120 contribution, you can choose to receive a copy of Diane Ravitch's book, The Death and Life of the Great American School System.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can distinguish yourself professionally and personally. Evening classes are available in Plano and Dallas. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Diane Ravitch. She is research professor of education at NYU and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Her new book is called The Death and Life of the Great American School System. She's in town to speak tonight to the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture. You can learn more about that at the Think page of KERA.org. Join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372. I want to talk for a minute about efforts to improve the faculties at public schools. You make a distinction between teacher training and teacher education. Can you explain that to us?
Sure. A lot of schools of education and a lot of states put emphasis on learning pedagogy. And I've been in ed schools for many, many years of my life, and I understand that what they're talking about is you learn the tricks of teaching. The problem is so many teachers are not well educated. And many young people go into teaching and they think if they get a degree in elementary education, secondary education, they'll be successful. But then when they get to school, they're assigned to teach history or science, and they may have taken a course or two, but it's not enough. They really do need, and I think if we were to compare ourselves to countries that do much, much better than we do on all these international tests, they expect their teachers to be very well educated.
Subject experts.
Well, I'm sorry, what did you say?
Experts in the subject
they're
teaching.
Oh, yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to teach history, you should have a master's degree in history because you have to love the subject in order to teach it. Of course, in my view, that's not enough. Once you have mastery of the subject yourself, you have to have the pedagogical courses to say, here's how you get this across to a 17-year-old. Here's how you get it across to an 11-year-old. And then you have to have the skills of classroom management. And I think that it's been my experience that there are many brilliant people who become teachers, and if they don't have the skills to manage the classroom or the ability to figure out how young people think, they're not going to be good teachers. So they do need the pedagogical skills, but if they only have pedagogical skills, that's not enough. They really do need a deep, deep understanding of whatever it is they're teaching. They have to love it. They have to be able to see different ways to look at it, to be able to raise questions, to get kids to go with them in this kind of journey of this is a great intellectual excitement and adventure that we're on learning about history and what really happened and what really happened the night that Lincoln was assassinated. What was President Roosevelt thinking? What was President Truman thinking? All these wonderful things that historians argue about. And the more you get into history, for example, the more you find that the issues that the textbooks say happened are really very controversial, that there's a lot of debate among historians about what really happened. And I think that somebody who loves the subject can get young people to say, hey, this is really exciting. I want to learn more. I want to read some stuff on my own.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Let's speak to Brad in Dallas. Hello, Brad.
Hello. I'm a teacher here in the Dallas area. I don't teach in Dallas ISD, but I teach band, actually. And I have found that since No Child Left Behind was put in place, the Texas switched over to the tax test, and basically, that's where the emphasis is here. At my particular school, the emphasis is on the tax scores, and that's all that's pushed. And so I feel like kids' education suffers because I have kids that obviously they're in band. They love music. They wouldn't sign up for it if they didn't like it. Yet every year I'm losing, you know, between 10 and 20% of my students to an extra math class or an extra reading class. Because they think that they need more assistance in those subjects, but I feel like that's short-sighted. When you look at me as a band teacher, I can incentivize my kids because they love my class, or an athletic student can be incentivized by that.
What do you think, Diane?
To do better in their other classes.
Brian, I think you're absolutely right that sometimes kids come to school because there's an arts program. Sometimes they come to school because they want to be in the band, or they want to be part of the dance program, or they want to do athletics. And as we're looking at the budget cuts going on across the country right now, the first thing to go are programs in the arts. And the more we boil schooling down to just reading and math, testing, teach, test, the more we're going to find kids dropping out because they're bored. So, yeah, we're losing the motivation, but what we're losing is a generation of young people who are well-educated.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. I want to talk about the motivation of individual students, and certainly having extracurricular activities that they're interested in is something, but you're very adamant about the idea that you can't incentivize students in the way that businesses incentivize employees. What's a good way to get students engaged in their own learning so that they feel an obligation as opposed to simply their teachers to do well in school?
Well, I'll tell you, let me start by telling you a bad way.
Okay.
A bad way is paying them to learn. And this has been a vogue or a fad in the last few years, this idea that we can incentivize kids if we give them X dollars for improving their grade or their test scores. And there's just a world of research and now evidence that shows, A, it doesn't work, and B, if it did work, we'd all be in deep trouble because we'd be paying kids and firing teachers because we can't afford to do that. But the reason it doesn't work is because when you get kids, it's like anything having to do with data. When you get kids focused on the goal of being paid, when the money stops, they stop caring. So you don't motivate them to learn. You just motivate them to earn the dollars, and then the dollars stop, and they're not motivated to learn anymore. I think the best way to motivate kids to learn is to get them genuinely interested. And with rare exceptions, all children have an interest that can be turned on. It may be by art. It may be by science. It may be by history. It may be by reading literature that makes them see the world differently than they had ever seen it before. It may be just involvement with poetry. You never know. But something is going to reach that child and say, this is something that is exciting. It's as exciting, if you can believe it, as a video game. And if you can reach that point, you're going to have a child who's a lifelong learner.
What concerns you about merit pay for teachers?
Well, it's the funny thing is the business community thinks that merit pay will work for teachers. It hasn't worked ever in education. There have been experiments in merit pay now since the 1920s, and it's like a fad. It comes and it goes. It never produces results. It actually creates dissension in the workforce, and there's a very big stream of thought within the business world that says merit pay is very destructive. It's destructive to the organization. What you want with especially a school, but also in a workforce, in a business place, is teamwork, collaboration, people joining together around the goals of the organization. If you pay two people differently who are doing the same job based on you got an A this time and you got a C, you create dissension in the workforce. You destroy the collaborative spirit. Instead of having teachers sitting together and sharing ideas about a good lesson plan or sharing ideas, so let's say, let's talk about Maria and why isn't she learning and what's her problem? And then they bring together what they know. But if they're working for different kinds of compensation, then they're not going to share and they're not going to work together towards the common goal of helping kids. So merit pay is a very destructive influence within schools, and it's never produced anything of any value in education, and probably not in the workforce either.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go next to Renee in Dallas. Hello, Renee.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
I'd like to ask a question about Ms. Ravitch's opinion on Teaching for America teachers. There's a lot of discussion about pros and cons regarding the cadre of teachers that are coming into that program, into the public schools and into public charters, and there's a lot of pros and cons. I'd like to get her opinion on that.
Sure. I think that Teach for America is a very nice program, and I think if I were just graduating college, I'd probably apply and want to join it. If I got accepted, I'd do it. I don't think, though, it's a solution to any important problem that we have today. Teach for America sends about somewhere in the neighborhood of 4,000 or 5,000 young people into the classrooms of the United States in hard-pressed urban and rural areas and difficult districts. And within 2 to 4 years, almost all of them are gone. So we have a profession in this country of over 3 million teachers. It's hard to see how the profession can be changed by the influx of young people. The other thing is the research about teacher effectiveness shows that the least effective teachers are those in their first 3 years of teaching. That's the time when Teach for America people come in, and then they're gone. And I think those who stay and become lifelong educators, that's great. But it's, again, if we're looking to rebuild the education profession, this is not the answer.
Talk about this new model in New York City where the schools are now under the control of City Hall. You are very concerned about this.
Yeah, it's a terrible model. This is called mayoral control. And I guess one of the reasons, as I look back over my own personal transformation about things like choice and accountability, is that Mayoral control in New York City started in 2002 is the same time as No Child Left Behind. And it's actually like the mirror image of No Child Left Behind. The mayor is a businessman. He appointed a lawyer to run the schools. And together they've made all the decisions. And they never listen to parents. They really, for a long time, didn't even listen to any educators. But first of all, it's not been fiscally responsible because they've doubled the budget in their time there. It went from $12 billion to, and now it's around $22 or $23 billion. So mayoral control, if you follow the New York model, is a way to dramatically increase spending. But more importantly, it's left out the public. The school board has no power. It's appointed by most of its members are appointed by the mayor and serve at his pleasure. And in the one instance where the school board dared to differ with him, he fired three members on the spot and got everybody to realize he's the boss. So what it does is that it completely removes any voice of the public. If parents don't like what's happening in the schools or to their kids, nobody cares. There's simply, you do it the mayor's way, and that's the only way. It just doesn't seem like the way public education should function. There has been a tremendous emphasis on choice, on accountability. Everything is test scores. It's NCLB writ small.
One thing I find astonishing about school board elections is the fact that the vast majority of voters who participate in other kinds of elections feel okay about skipping these, even if they have kids in public schools at the time. How do we communicate the relevance of making a choice at the ballot box in terms of the school board population?
I think people who run in school board elections have a hard time getting people to vote because they're just not well known enough. It's rare that you have a school board race that's going to be as important and get as much media attention as a citywide race. And most people are running in districts where they just don't have enough media visibility and the issues are not large enough and sharply drawn enough to draw out a large number of people. I've studied American schools for 40 years now. And what I've concluded is that governance, unless it gets in the way of improving schools, governance is not a solution. There are very good districts that have elected boards. There are very good districts that have appointed boards. We have the highest performing cities that are tested by the federal government are Charlotte and Austin, Texas. They don't have mayoral control. The lowest performing cities at this point would be Cleveland, which has mayoral control, Chicago, which has mayoral control, but also Detroit, which does not have mayoral control, and Milwaukee, which doesn't have mayoral. I mean, if we just had this one system, we could solve all our problems. The problems of public education really go to issues of curriculum, of professionalism, of having a coherent and consistent vision of what good education is and then doing all the things to make that happen. And also it goes to really the economic condition of the city itself. A city like Detroit is a city that's almost right now in a deep, deep, deep depression. The jobs have left Detroit. The population is deeply impoverished. And people are saying, well, the schools are no good. Well, there are no jobs for the parents, and the kids come from very impoverished homes. And I don't know what the schools can do to change that. They can certainly try to get better, and I'd love to see better leadership there, better teachers. All these things need to be improved. But the schools don't solve the problem of a community that's in deep economic distress.
Diane Ravitch is my guest. Her new book is called The Death and Life of the Great American School System. She's in town to speak to the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture. We'll resume our conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org. You can join KERA as a supporting member at any level by calling 1-888-694-6931. You can also go online to kera.org. Hello again, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. And we've heard from a few people. Chris, so far, thanks to the generous donations of many listeners, has raised $337,240 toward our overall goal of $700,000 for this membership campaign. And the deal we made when we started still stands. Once we reach that final goal, the drive ends. Now, we'd really like to end the drive by Friday, by the end of the day, Friday this week. Well, that means we have a couple of days to get there. And your contribution right now may be at a higher level if you've waited, if you haven't done your part, if you can join the station at, say, the $500 level or the $1,500 friends level, that would be fantastic because it would really kind of move us along toward that ultimate goal and really toward wrapping up the drive, which is what we all want to do. We want to do it, too. We know you want us to do it. We want to do it, too, but it takes your participation to make it happen.
1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number. KERA.org is the website. If you are already a member and your membership is current, please don't discount. First of all, thank you. And then please don't discount the value of your influence on other people who love public radio but may not realize that we really do want everyone to make a contribution. Everyone who listens, we ask to kick in some money. Now, you may be able to do $5. You may be able to do $5,000. That's up to you. But your contribution does count. And letting your friends and family know, maybe on Facebook or Twitter or something, that you're a supporting member certainly is good for us. And we definitely appreciate the extra effort if you're willing to do it.
Well, it's good for you, too, because then if you can convince some of your friends to join the station as well,
they'll help end the pledge drive.
You're not alone, right? You know, we all want to be part of a winning team. And, you know, when you tune to KERA 90.1, when you tune in to the Think Show or any of the shows that you hear on 90.1, you are joining a winning team. This is a very successful public radio station. It's the only public radio station, except for that other one down the hall, which is also here in the building.
The music station.
The music
very
station.
Nice music station.
It's the only one in the fifth media market in the country. It's your source for all things NPR. It's your only source for shows like Think, where, you know, we really are thrilled to be able to bring conversations right to you wherever you are. As long as you're within earshot of a radio, you can always tune in. You can always pick up the phone and call in or email in a question or a comment. It's really your forum. And we do this every day, not for us, not for advertisers, not for corporations who support the station and who sponsor our show. No, we do it for you. The decisions that we make in this building, and especially on this show, are 100% made in service to you. We're just asking that you support this not-for-profit educational organization that brings you this kind of programming with a contribution at 888-694-6931 or online at kera.org.
The standard that we try to achieve in producing this program is that it is locally based. Certainly everything is sort of filtered through a North Texas lens, but we want it to sound as good as anything you might hear nationally. And we know that that's what you expect of us. That's what you continue to know that you will receive when you tune into the station. We hope that we are often able to meet that standard. But your expectations, it's fair to tie them to our expectations that you will make a contribution to make sure that public radio can stay strong in this community. You can receive a copy of The Death and Life of the Great American School System, How Testing and Choice Are Undermining Education by Diane Ravitch, if you make a contribution now at the $120 level or above. Or you can choose to just go buy the book and adjust your thank you gift adjust your gift to the station accordingly.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, we encourage you, if this is something that's interesting to you, go out, get the book at your favorite brick and mortar or your favorite online retailer. But please do support the station that let you know about it and that sparked your interest. You can do that at 888-694-6931 or contribute online at kera.org. Please don't wait. Please do it right now. We want to wrap the drive this week, 1-888-694-6931.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can distinguish yourself professionally and personally. Evening classes are available in Plano and Dallas. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Diane Ravitch. She is research professor of education at New York University and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Her new book is called The Death and Life of the Great American School System. She'll be speaking tonight to the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Let's go back to the phones now, and this time we will speak with Marilyn in Seven Points. Hello, Marilyn.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
I'm a passionate teacher. I've been teaching over 35 years.
Thank you.
And I've taught in public school. I'm now teaching community college. I've even taught in Texas prisons. I'm always surprised that no one mentions this. This is not a matter of classroom management. What I see happening in the schools is bullying, destruction of property, they get a big kick out of going to the bathroom and selling their Ritalin to each other. Parents come up and interfere with grading. Basically, I left public schools because I was required to pass people who had never even put their name on the top of the page. And this is not an isolated incident. Jane Nelson encountered this, a representative, and tried to do something about passing a law about it. But it still exists. Kids are being passed for doing absolutely nothing.
You know, it's a shame to hear, Diane, a teacher with as much experience as Marilyn has so frustrated with the way things work in the school. And it sounds like discipline is an issue and then interference is an issue.
Right. Well, one of the things I point out in the book is that if we can learn one lesson from charter schools, it's the importance of establishing behavioral standards. And I think back to my own education in the Houston public schools, and we had behavioral standards. And we really have, as a society, we have to ask ourselves, how do we let them go? Why do we have kids in school bullying each other and bullying teachers? And this isn't right. No one's going to want to teach in schools where the kids are out of control. But a lot of this comes from the lack of any parental guidance. And this, I think, is one of the things I'm very upset about right now is there's a very popular notion in the country that we should judge teachers. We should pay teachers based on their students' test scores. The Obama administration is pushing this idea. If you want to participate in their $5 billion Race to the Top program and be eligible, you have to say that you're willing to judge teachers by student test scores. Well, one of the reasons that I don't like this is that it makes, in effect, puts the teacher's future in the hands of the students. If the students are angry at the teacher and then get low test scores, the teacher's cooked. But, you know, its test scores are shaped by so many different things, by the student's effort, by the student's motivation, by the family support, the family lack of support, and yet only the teachers will be held accountable. But I think that Marilyn's quite right that school districts and school leaders really have to get serious about bringing parents in, bringing students in, and maintaining standards of discipline. You can't have education where there's no decent behavior.
How would the U.S. educational system change if we had a national standardized curriculum?
Well, I think that, you know, in my view, I think it'll be very hard to get there. I would love to see us have a national curriculum, but it would be a curriculum that would not be limited to reading and math. It would be one in which we recognize that there are some seminal events in American history and in world history that all kids should know about. I was very involved some 20 years ago in writing the California state history curriculum, and we dealt with lots of controversial issues, but we didn't say this is right and this is wrong, this is better, this is... But we just laid it out there and said to teachers, these are the guidelines. And that curriculum has been in place actually since 1988, still being taught, and it's very powerful. I would like to see a national curriculum in mathematics and in the teaching of foreign languages and in the arts. At the time I was assistant secretary working for the first President Bush, we funded the development of national guidelines, curriculum guidelines, in every subject area, not just limited to reading and math. And We didn't get past the funding of them, the announcing of them, because the country wasn't ready for it. I'm not sure it's ready now, but I'd certainly like to see every state have strong curriculum guidelines where we could go beyond this notion that you don't need to teach something unless it's tested. You have to begin with a vision of what's good education. And if you leave out the arts, and if you leave out science, and if you leave out history and literature and geography and civics, it's not good education. That's where we are today.
There are a couple of ways to look at our failure to ensure that every American student who graduates from high school is proficient in a language other than English. There's the sort of cynical way to say that it's, you know, American hegemony and we just don't assume we'll need anything other than English. And then there's also the view that there's too much else going on and there just isn't time to focus from, you know, pre-kindergarten all the way up through high school on really learning a language. Where do you fall?
Oh, I think that every student should learn one other language. One of them, they should have two languages, one of which should be English. Mm-hmm. But I think that it's whatever language it is, and I think districts will differ depending on which border they're close to or which ocean they're close to and what their resources are. I think that every district should offer young people the opportunity to learn a second language.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next on the line is Andrea in Dallas. Hello, Andrea.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Long-time supporter of the station.
Thank
and
you.
Also, shout out to the streaming because I often stream and podcast, and I support there too. And just want to thank you for all the great work that you guys do.
Oh, that's great. Thank you.
My question really has to do with my experience with my teenage daughter now in middle school, but the experience has really been with several different principals, and we're in the public school, have been probably for the past 6 years. And it's really varied. So my question is to your guest about has to do with principals and how do they, you know, contribute to the academic success or the demise of the schools? And really what do parents need to do to create a I guess, an amiable working environment. Maybe that's not the word I'm looking for. But, you know, a functional and successful working environment so that everybody wins. The students succeed and the school succeeds.
Thanks for your call.
Well, I think that the parents are clearly the children's first educator. And we know from lots and lots of both experience and research that by the time children are 3 years old, they already have huge differences in terms of their vocabulary, believe it or not. There's an enormous gap in the amount of words that kids hear by the age they're three. And if they're living in a home where the parents are educated, they hear a lot of different words. If they're living in a home where the parents don't speak English or are very poor, they will hear very few words. That's been well documented. By the time kids are five, there's an enormous gap. So what parents need to do, and I think this is true whether parents have income or they don't have income, is they need to talk to their children. They need to read to them. They need to, as soon as they're able to, take them to a library, get them a library card, take them to museums, take them to whatever civic or cultural sites or historical sites and talk about it. Let them hear a lot of words, different words, not just yes, no, stop, and don't. And I think that this is where children get ready for school. If we had great parenting in this country, we would have far, far better schools without a single government mandate.
And what about the role of school administrators and principals? It sounds like, yeah, from Andrea's experience, they can either get in the way or they can really help.
Right. Well, there's been a trend in the past few years to bring in non-educators as principals and are people who've been a teacher for a year or two and say, you can take a course at the local university called How to Be a Leader and then, you know, poof, you're a principal. I think this is a wrong direction to go. Right now, there's enormous emphasis around the country in evaluating teachers and firing teachers and judging teachers. Who's going to make that evaluation? It's got to be the principal, first off. And the principal has to be somebody who is already an experienced, I would say, a master teacher. Because if you have, we have every year new people coming into teaching, although in this recession there won't be as many as there have been in the past. But when new people come in, they're not very good teachers, and they need to have a principal who can say, I know how to help you. I know how to show you what you need to do to get better. But if you have a principal who is not a master teacher, they can't help the teacher. They can't even understand what the problem is. So I think it's very crucial to have principals who are excellent teachers, who are well-organized. Principals really can be truly the leaders of their school. And it's a big mistake that we're making right now to recruit principals from the ranks of brand new teachers or from the business community or from places where they don't have that deep, deep knowledge of what it takes to make a good school.
Diane Ravitch is research professor of education at New York University and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Her new book is called The Death and Life of the Great American School System. Diane, it's been a pleasure to have you in. Thank you so much for spending the hour here.
Thank you, and I hope all your guests contribute to NPR and particularly to KERA. You do a great job.
Thank you for the unsolicited plug. It's lovely to have. You can choose to receive a copy of Diane's fascinating new book. If you have a child in the public school system, if you will at some point, if you have a grandchild, if you simply care about the future of this country, it's a really interesting read. We have that available as a thank you at the $120 contribution level. You can call 1-888-694-6931. You can go to us online at kera.org. The transaction only takes a minute or two. So before we start our next hour of content with Greil Marcus talking about the career of Van Morrison, you have time to get this all taken care of, to support KERA, and to ensure yourself that you'll have another great year of public radio in North Texas. Hello, Jeff Whittington.
Hey, Chris Boyd, and hello to you. What a great conversation. What a thrill and honor to have the Diane Ravitch in studio. She's been a guest on the phone before, but as a matter of fact, I think this is the first time she's ever had a speaking engagement in Dallas, her speaking engagement this evening, which is sold out. But, you know, we're thrilled and thank the Dallas Institute for Humanities and Culture for helping make her available today for you so that you could hear the conversation, so that you could respond to it, so that you could get something out of it. And that's what public radio and KERA is all about, is you getting something out of it. And that's why we're asking you to contribute to it, because you do. You listen every day. You've sampled the product. You keep coming back for more. We're just asking you to help pay the bills. And, you know, and it is a challenging time for a lot of folks, and we understand that. But if you can afford to help the station, if you can make a contribution, if you can, if you're willing to make that kind of commitment to the station, please call 888-694-6931. Please go online today to KERA.org and make a contribution. It's really crucial we hear from you.
You can think maybe of a million reasons why you don't feel like making a call right now. You're in the middle of something. And the assumption is on your part, I'm guessing, that KERA will be here regardless, that someone else will sort of take it on. You know, it may be that people who have supported the station in the past are having a tough year right now. You can make a difference when you become a member. We really ask everyone who listens to the station, and I cannot stress this enough, and I don't know how to sort of get it through to everyone. Everyone who listens, we hope that you will make a contribution. Now, the amount of the contribution is up to you. It can be a few dollars. It can be a few $100s. I think the average is something like 110 or 20. But that amount's your business. But we ask that you make a call at 1-888-694-6931 and become a member of the station.
1-888-694-6931 is the number to call. You can go online to KERA.org, make your contribution there. Of course, we do have copies of Diane Ravitch's book, The Death and Life of the Great American School System. Pretty controversial book. There's certainly been a lot of written about the book. And, you know, we're really excited to be able to bring her into our, ongoing conversation about what's going to work and what's not going to work, or what might work, what might not work, or what you think is working in the education system. We always hear from teachers. We always hear from concerned parents. We always hear from people across the spectrum. Whether you agree or disagree with a guest on this show, that's great. We're thrilled that you listen and, you know, you participate in the conversation. Please do consider, though, that it costs money to turn the lights on in here. It costs, an expense that comes with making a public radio station work.
1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number. You can also go to KERA.org to make a contribution. You may recall that just a few weeks ago, certainly within the last month and a half, we had Paul E. Peterson on, who was talking about how to save American schools. His perspective and Diane's perspective, at this point, they used to be sort of similar in the way they looked at things. And at this point, Diane's is very different. I think it's amazing to be able to work at a place where it's not my job to tell you, you should side with Paul E. Peterson or you should side with Diane Ravitch. I think it's amazing to be able to speak with both of them about their very interesting and intelligent ideas and find out how they arrived at their conclusions. And then we let you make the choice for yourself. We never bring a guest on here and say, this is someone that you should absolutely agree with or disagree with. We just want to put it out there. And lifelong learners, like we know that you are who listen to KERA, recognize the value of that as a resource in your own life. Please also recognize the value of the station that brings it to you and the expenses that we incur in order to make it possible.
1-888-694-6931 is the phone number. You can go online to KERA.org and take care of it there. It's as affordable as you want it to be. You know, if the $500 contribution is right for you, and, you know, we know that the station reaches a wide variety of people at all different economic abilities and you know, all different aspects. I mean, that's what's so wonderful about public radio is the diversity of the audience. You know what? If the $500 contribution is right for you, that really will help us get that much closer to finishing this membership campaign. Call us, 888-694-6931. Go online to KERA.org and make that contribution today.
You can be entered into this drawing we have going for an iPod Touch. You can make a contribution online or you can call 1-888-694-6931. You can also online and make this contribution. At 6:30 today, we will draw from among the names of people who've made contributions before 6:30, or I guess the drawing is at 6:45, and you have a chance to win this nifty little toy.
And you know, if you've already made a contribution, or even if maybe your membership is current, you don't have to make a contribution today to get entered in the drawing.
Right, it's not a sweepstakes.
Right, it's not a raffle. It's a drawing. You can call, you can go online and make your and just sign up for the drawing. Mm-hmm. We hope that you will be motivated to make a contribution, though, to KERA. It is 90.1 KERA, Dallas-Fort Worth, Denton. Also, 100.1 K261 CW in Tyler, 88.3 K202 DR in Wichita Falls, and 99.3 K257 EV in Sherman. But no matter where you listen, it's your public radio station, and your public radio station needs your help. You know, we've got bills to pay here, And we didn't just throw a dart at the wall and say, oh, $700,000 is the goal. No, we put a lot of thought into it and a very careful consideration. And rest assured that when you send money to the station, it's your money is going to be treated very carefully. There'll be a lot of thought that goes into how to spend your very generous dollars. So please do your part today.
To be honest, I think like a lot of you, we had hoped to be closer to the goal by this point in the drive.
Sure.
We're a little behind where we would like to be at this stage. Now, we'll get to our goal, but we'll just sort of keep going until we make it. We know, just like you, that this is not everybody's favorite kind of programming, that fundraising is not the thing you love the most about KERA. You can make a statement, help us finish the drive, and also support radio that you believe is an important resource in your community now by calling 1-888-694-6931. You can also go online and make a contribution at kera.org. Thank you so much.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.